Welcome back to The Last Week in Medicine. It's February 3rd. I'm Stephen Jenkins, and today I'm welcoming back my prodigal co-host, Dr. Austin Rupp.
Hello, everyone. Great to be back. Glad. Thanks for having me back, Stephen. Great to be here.
Always a pleasure. Dr. Rupp took two weeks ago off. He had his folks in town. That was nice. Came to see baby Gus, I imagine.
Yeah, Dr. Bunch, I just had my first child a month ago, so I've been on a little bit of a hiatus.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So today we have a very special guest joining us, Dr. Jared Bunch. Hey, Dr. Bunch.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So Dr. Bunch is an electrophysiologist and a professor of medicine. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm from Utah originally, Logan, Utah. Then I came to the University of Utah and then spent about a decade at the Mayo Clinic before returning. I started at Intermountain Medical Center and ran their electrophysiology research, and then led their heart rhythm services throughout the system for about a decade. Then came up here to the University of Utah about a year and a half ago, about the same time COVID came, and become the section chief here over heart rhythm services at the University of Utah.
Yeah, we were very glad you made the move and came to the promised land of the U of U. So we're very lucky. So you have a family?
I do. I'm married and I have six kids, and two in college, and the youngest is eight. So we span a broad range.
Awesome.
I'm having trouble with one, so maybe you'll have to give me some pointers offline.
No, you spend less time with each one. The first one, you're worried about every move. The last one could not move for 2 years, and you don't move. It doesn't concern you. You consider that a victory.
They just start to raise themselves after a while.
Exactly.
So you grew up in Logan, is that right? You're a Utah State Aggie?
I am an Aggie.
Very cool. Is that where your wife went to school as well? Or?
Yeah, we met at Utah State. She's from Centerville, Bountiful area, and she tells me it may have been false advertising on my part, but she took me on anyway.
So are you a true Aggie?
Oh, I was actually the DJ for the True Aggie event 1 year. I did a lot of work in their student government. So,
all right.
I know all about it. And if those people can let me know, and I can get them to the right people to become True Aggies.
All right. For our listeners, if you don't know what a True Aggie is, you can Google it. All right. Well, we invited Dr. Bunch on the podcast today to talk about a couple papers that were published last week in the New England Journal about cryoballoon ablation for atrial fibrillation. And Dr. Bunch happens to be an international expert on catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation. So thank you very much for joining us. When I was a medical student, I remember the AFFIRM trial just getting like drilled into my skull by all of my attendings. And that trial was published back in 2002. So what has changed in the world of AFib since then?
Yeah, well, that's still a foundational trial. So we had the AFFIRM trial and the atrial fibrillation CHF trial. And these were trials that really said, should we use medications and shock hearts to restore sinus rhythm with atrial fibrillation, to maintain what we call a rhythm control strategy, or should we just slow the heart down and make sure it doesn't go too fast, and in both arms then try to use anticoagulation to prevent stroke. And those trials both came out showing no benefit. The atrial fibrillation heart failure trial was a little more effective than the AFFIRM trial. You know, the AFFIRM trial, a lot of the patients did not maintain sinus rhythm, and a third transferred over to the rate control arm due to failure. And so what was found out after that, though, was those patients in either trial that stayed on anticoagulation and were in sinus rhythm, they did better. So it left out the question, what if we get better therapies, safer therapies, will the benefit of sinus rhythm come about? And so now move forward about 10 years, and some of the trials have investigated that. One trial was called the Cabana trial, which was a trial where they randomized over 2,000 people to medicine versus ablation. And these were patients that were just referred to an electrophysiologist, so they may have had treatment before. And that trial showed that heart failure hospitalizations were reduced, a combination of stroke and heart failure hospitalizations were reduced. The primary endpoint included mortality wasn't with ablation, but those other things were. But arrhythmia burden, those patients that stayed in sinus rhythm, ablation was twice as effective as medical therapy. Last year, another key trial called the East AFNet trial was published in the New England Journal. And one of the problems with CABANA is that patients that had paroxysmal atrial fibrillation that comes and goes versus persistent, or those that had atrial fibrillation for a number of years, they didn't do as well with either therapy. So the East AFNet trial was designed just to look at people that had atrial fibrillation diagnosed within a year and randomized to ablation, to rhythm control, and that included ablation or medicines, or just watching how they do. And that trial, if you have atrial fibrillation within a year and you're treated with medications or ablation, that lowered the risk of stroke and mortality and acute coronary syndrome. So since that time, we've had this trend with multiple trials that have shown that ablation is more effective than medicine, including a massive trial, CABANA. And we now have a trial that said, you know, if we're going to do rhythm control, we should do it earlier, that it can impact hard endpoints or alter the natural history of atrial fibrillation, which still is plagued with mortality risk, a heart failure risk, and stroke risk. And we've done little for mortality and heart failure risk when you look at the Framingham data over 40 years. So these trials are now showing that we can impact that if we act early enough and with safe therapies.
So Dr. Bunch, my sense, you know, was even after AFFIRM came out and several other trials, which had great names, by the way, the cardiology trials always have best names, right? I think there was a hot cafe trial at one point too that I stumbled across. But anyway, my sense is that EP cardiologists and the cardiology community as a whole just felt like the AFFIRM trial wasn't representative of the advancing technology that EP cardiologists had at their fingertips, right? So ablations were getting better, medications were getting better, and is that part of the impetus behind why this has sort of just continued to be studied, and that sort of we just didn't really feel like AFFIRM was you know, actually the right answer to the question, is a rhythm control strategy better than a rate control?
Well, you're right, and AFFIRM never could answer the question because the rhythm control arm didn't work. The drugs were difficult to take. A lot of them are pro-arrhythmic, and even when you took them, and if you took them safely, they didn't work 60% of the time. So we were plagued with a very poor, or we were limited by a very, very poor therapies. But when AFFIRM was running ablation's a new technology, and in the late 1990s, we were ablating AV nodes and still trying to figure out how to ablate atrial fibrillation, trying to follow the Mays procedure. So at that time, there really wasn't anything. Now, the antiarrhythmic, there's also different antiarrhythmic drugs. We have dofetilide or Teicosin. That is more tolerated. I wouldn't say it's more safe than Sotalol, but it more tolerated because it doesn't lower heart rates. And then we have Multaq, which is weak, which is tolerated well. It's not very effective, but that's the one antiarrhythmic drug that actually was shown to lower stroke rates in the Athena trial. So perhaps we have a more tolerated and a little bit safer drugs plus ablation now. And the East AFNet included all of that. And in Europe, because Multaq or dromedarone is more cost-effective, they use it more often. And so it represented about 15% of the East AFNet trial.
So we're just, simple country internists, but could you kind of explain to us how cryoballoon ablation works and how maybe it's different from radio frequency ablation, and is one better than the other, and what do we do here at the University of Utah?
Well, I'll start with the one question. Is one better than the other? There was a great trial that looked at that called fire and ice, radio frequency ablation, hot, and cryoballoon, cold. And what it found is both technologies worked. And we've learned, and there wasn't a difference between the two. And we've learned that what you need to do is choose the tool you do better and do that and master that. Radio frequency ablation, I use that, is I can control it, the tip, precisely, and move around the veins, and I like that control. So I've used it, even though I was part of the early cryoballoon development at Mayo and the very early cryoballoon trials. I like the control of the RF that I go point by point and go around the pulmonary veins to isolate them. The value of the cryoballoon is you just put the balloon in the vein and you blow it up and then cool the vein, and it really homogenizes procedural experience and operator experience. You know, we all kind of put it in the same spot and it cools in this homogeneous pattern. And so cryoballoon has really helped a lot of people have good outcomes that may have lower volumes, and people that have higher volumes can use it extremely effectively. I just like more of a control of the injury pattern, so that's why I don't use it, but I know a lot of great operators that do. At the University of Utah, we don't currently have somebody that actively does cryoballoon. We have in the past, but all of us kind of have that same, we really want to control where the injury is going, so we haven't. But it may be offered in the future if we recruit somebody that's the tool they want to use.
Very good. Well, Austin, do you want to jump in and take us through the STOP AF first trial?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, thanks for that, Dr. Bunch. I think we sort of have, you know, a background here to get started. So STOP AF first, or cryoballoon ablation as initial therapy for atrial fibrillation, was published by Dr. Wozni and colleagues. Initially appeared online November 16th, 2020 in the New England Journal. They included 225 patients from June 2017 to May 2019. Patients were 18 to 80 years old with recurrent symptomatic paroxysmal atrial fibrillation across 24 centers in the U.S. Key exclusion criteria were previous use of antiarrhythmic drugs for greater than 7 days and large left atrial diameter and previous ablation or left atrial surgical procedure. Patients were randomized to pulmonary vein isolation with cryoballoon versus antiarrhythmic meds. They were followed up in the office at 1, 3, 6, and 12 months with EKGs, had weekly telephone follow-up, and if symptoms developed, and 24-hour ambulatory EKG monitoring at 6 and 12 months. And that's worth noting, they did not have implantable loop recorders in these patients, which Stephen will talk about for his trial, but just got periodic EKGs and had folks call in if they had symptoms. The primary efficacy endpoint was treatment success at 12 months, which was defined as freedom from the following: subsequent AFib surgery or ablation, atrial arrhythmia recurrence, cardioversion, and use of class 1 or 3 antiarrhythmic drugs in the ablation group. So if they had any of those, they had a primary efficacy endpoint event and were included did not have treatment success. The safety endpoints were kind of what you'd expect: the development of a clinically significant pericardial effusion, symptomatic pulmonary vein stenosis, or atrial esophageal fistula within 12 months, phrenic nerve injury, and some CV outcomes, including TIA, strokes, myocardial infarction, major bleeding, etc., within the first 7 days. So they randomized 203 patients, 104 to ablation and 99 to medications. 193 patients completed 12 months of follow-up. The baseline characteristics were similar between the groups, and it should be noted that the mean age for ablation was 60.4, and the medication group had a mean age of 61.6. The mean time from atrial fibrillation onset to randomization was 1.3 years, and about 55% of both groups of patients had hypertension. So the primary endpoint occurred in 74.6%, or the primary endpoint, which was treatment success at 12 months, was 74.6% in the ablation group and 45% in the medication group, with a confidence interval of 34.6 to 54.7 and a p-value of less than 0.001. So obviously the ablation group did better than the medication group with a statistically significant p-value. I don't think it's that important to sort of go through the nitty gritty here. You know, there was, you know, a few patients within the, procedure group did have, the primary safety endpoint met, two specifically. So there was a pericardial effusion and a myocardial infarction. 15 patients in the medication group did end up crossing over to ablation, which, you know, was a primary efficacy endpoint event in those folks. They talk about serious adverse events, which were 14% in both groups. And then some of the secondary outcomes were notable for being positive for the ablation group. So quality of life improved in the ablation group. And there were a few other kind of smaller secondary events or secondary endpoints that were positive for ablation. So, you know, I think here, the ablation group did better than the medication group. A few thoughts that I had about the trial were that Medtronic helped sponsored it. They used a modified intention to treat protocol, so they only ended up using folks who were actually randomized, or they only evaluated folks who were actually randomized. The patients in this trial were potentially, you know, healthier and maybe a little bit younger than kind of the typical AFib patient. You know, it couldn't be blinded. And, you know, maybe, again, not quite representative of the folks that we see as hospitalists, but I think, you know, a positive trial for ablations here.
Yeah, and I think that's correct. So as you can imagine, radio frequency ablation can mimic the maze procedure where we have different lines for more advanced disease. And the balloon really can't do that. Some people try, but it's really designed for pulmonary vein isolation, which is linked more so to paroxysmal atrial fibrillation and more advanced diseases. And one thing we learned from Cabana is kind of hit on all its endpoints if you took the patients that actually got an ablation. But within that group, some people didn't. Their insurance said no, they just didn't want it. And so the trials have learned from Cabana. They said, well, we're going to truly test ablation. We want to make sure you get it. So, you know, intention to treat, of course, is the purest way to look at something statistically in these trials. But when you're a proceduralist, you really want also to look at per protocol where they actually got or on treatment or they got it. And so these trials, of course, that are industry sponsored, there's a lot of money on the line with Medtronic to show their device is good. So they want to make sure it's truly evaluated. But that's an important limitation in this analysis, you know, they're already selected people that get through the process to get the ablation and actually receive it. With the cryo balloon, the one, you know, ablation, there's a 1 in 1,000 to 2 in 1,000 risk of thrombolism, stroke, bleeding, effusion. But the cryo balloon, because it's a circumferential sphere, it can actually injure things outside of the pulmonary vein orifice. And the most concerning when you interpret a cryo balloon study, or when you find a patient that's had, or as you see a patient that's had a cryo balloon ablation, is phrenic nerve injury. And historically, that rate's been anywhere from 5 to 10%, and most of the time it does resolve, but these trials report that uniquely compared to radio frequency, because that is a common problem with cryo balloon therapy.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna I couldn't figure out how that would have happened, but I was just gonna let it go, as I'm not quite an EP cardiologist, so thanks for the insight. Yeah, there.
Right-sided, and it's just that right superior pulmonary vein goes right behind the SVC, and the phrenic nerve runs right on the SVC. So when you push it far enough, again, it's a big ice ball, you can ding it.
Interesting. I guess one thought I had about this trial was, you know, it's interesting that the way they assess success was with these, you know, intermittent EKGs, and, you know, they did some ambulatory monitoring for 24 hours at two different intervals. I guess the risk there is that you would overestimate the benefit, because you could miss a lot of atrial fibrillation that's happening outside of those intervals where you're actually monitoring.
Yeah, and that's our society's agreed upon things that don't make a lot of sense. One is this definition of 30 seconds of fibrillation recurrence as failure. If you're a patient, that may not mean a lot, and they just sort of decided on a number. And that's important for the next trial, because I think our field starts saying, you know, should we really say it's a failure if you have 30 seconds of AFib? But you're very right. These trials that spot check and our devices, most of our monitors like that people are using all the time, like Apple Watch, they're spot checking, and you can miss subclinical arrhythmia. Some of the pro ablation people say it doesn't matter because people aren't pushing the button, it's not bugging them. But when you get at questions regarding atrial fibrillation burden and stroke risk, atrial fibrillation burden and heart failure risk, then subclinical arrhythmia is relevant, and missing it is relevant. So this is a very historic, consistent trial design. Uh-huh. With these periodic checks, independent of symptoms, but all of them can miss that. And that's what's so nice about early AFib, because it starts answering beyond this.
Yeah, so we can segue into that paper then. So the early AF trial was published in print January 28th in the New England Journal. First author was Dr. Andrade. And it had a similar, you know, design as far as randomizing patients to either antiarrhythmic therapy or ablation. It was a little bit bigger than the last trial. They had 303 patients enrolled, and it was at 18 centers in Canada. And so one of the things that was different about this trial, like Austin mentioned, is all the patients did undergo insertion of an implantable cardiac monitor. And then they were also given a device to record symptomatic episodes. So they were able to pick up pretty much any arrhythmia at all during the trial period, which I think is really cool. The choice of the antiarrhythmic was left up to the prescribing doctor. If the drug was ineffective or had too many side effects, they could change to a second or third agent within that first 90 days of the trial. It looked like the most common drug they used was flecainide. Would you say that's the most commonly used antiarrhythmic for AFib right now, or that just happened to be what they use in Canada?
For early paroxysmal, yes. You know, obviously, it's excluded in people with coronary disease, but yeah, it's our most common in those that don't have coronary disease and a healthy heart.
Is that, man, that's like taking me back. Is that like the CAST trial? Was that?
CAST trial, and it's interpolated from that, but that's heart attack, scar, PVC related to the scar, but people died on it. So they said, well, I'm just not even going to mess with it with atrial fibrillation, but it really needs to be done in atrial fibrillation, which is a completely different rhythm.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. Patients who were assigned to ablation got the pulmonary vein isolation with the cryo balloon. So they had a 90-day blanking period after receiving ablation where any recurrence of atrial tachyarrhythmia was not counted towards the primary endpoint. And I believe the other study did that too, the blanking period. Can you comment on that at all, Dr. Bunch?
Yeah, so we see a lot of arrhythmia early on in the first 3 months that's independent of long-term risk. It's just related to, could be pericarditis, just inflammation of the atrium, us being in there and poking things. And so we blank that just because it doesn't have a long-term significance as far as their long-term recurrence rates. And again, it's somewhat arbitrarily decided that 90-day window, but we do have now MRI data that really shows kind of the inflammatory pattern and then the maturation of scar in the heart taking about that long. So I think now there's some imaging correlation that supports it.
Okay. So the primary endpoint for this study was first recurrence of any atrial tachyarrhythmia, including AFib, aflutter, or atrial tachycardia, after that blanking period up to a year after initiation of treatment. And so this outcome was a little different than the last paper, which was freedom from recurrence. This one is actually a recurrent episode is the endpoint, which was a little more intuitive for me. The secondary endpoints they used were first recurrence of symptomatic AFib, arrhythmia burden, and success of multiple ablation procedures, quality of life, healthcare utilization, and serious adverse events. Overall, the baseline characteristics were well balanced. And so at 1 year, there was a documented recurrence of atrial tachyarrhythmia in 42.9% of those who got ablation and 67.8% of patients assigned to drugs, which was, you know, definitely a significant difference. Symptomatic AFib occurred in 11% of ablation patients and 26% of drug patients. And then because they had that implantable recorder, they were able to measure total atrial fibrillation burden. And the median atrial fibrillation burden or percentage of time patient was in AFib was 0% in the ablation arm and 0.13% in the drug arm. So overall, both seemed to work pretty well as far as total time in AFib. Pretty negligible difference between the two. But I guess that's because you're recording very short bursts maybe of rhythm changes over a much longer denominator. So I don't know what you thought about that.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, you're looking at earlier patients, paroxysmal, so it comes and goes. And even without treatment, they may go a month without it. So that's important. But what we found, Benjamin Steinberg here at the University of Utah has been using massive pacemaker databases, because we often, and I did, I think I, we often think of atrial fibrillation, well, it's some sort of continuum that we're all, you have atrial fibrillation, you're either at 0% or 100, and there's probably a bell-shaped curve. But what his work has shown is really there's a big group that has very little fib, paroxysmal, and a big group that has a lot. It's persistent. And there's not a lot of people in the middle. And so we're finding that people kind of gravitate towards one group or the other. This does fit that. There's a lot of people out there. Go.
I think overall, you know, this trial was similar in that it was definitely a positive, you know, trial for in favor of ablation. I think the strengths of this paper was there was not a lot of crossover between the groups. You really were comparing drug versus ablation. They had that implantable recorder, which was nice. I think really the only major limitation I saw was, you know, it was big enough for the outcome they were looking at, but it wasn't really big enough to look at these major cardiovascular outcomes that you could measure like in the Cabana trial, as far as reducing risk of stroke and heart attacks and heart failure and those things.
Yeah, and it really gets cost prohibitive. I was part of the executive board of Cabana through the whole process, and you know, it was nearing $80 million to pull that trial off. So you can imagine how much these trials with an expensive therapy start costing. But I think this trial really, this burden data is really important for interpretation of the older trials. And that now it really, people felt great, even if they had 30 seconds of fibrillation that we said is a failure in the past. And so I think the newer trials are going to look more at burden and then rather than saying a 30 seconds is a failure, because people do feel better. Because in the end of the day, most of atrial fibrillation management is for symptoms and quality of life. And so we have to do much better in our field in including that. Is an important endpoint rather than this historic 30 seconds failure cutoff.
Yeah, it was interesting that the symptomatic AFib was so much lower with both groups, but you know, for ablation, it was only 11% of patients had symptomatic AFib. You know, versus 43% had some AFib on their monitor. So the patients felt great, I'm sure.
Here at the University of Utah, we can, you know, everybody gets these quality of life surveys, and we can look at people and how they feel and what they report and if they're in atrial fibrillation. And atrial fibrillation patients, once you have it, you feel your heart differently. And so oftentimes you're more symptomatic, not only from your fibrillation, but from other rhythms as well. And so it's nice to see a general reduction overall after a procedure. It is an invasive procedure, so there's some influence with that, but a general symptom, because some people get quite debilitated just overall from multiple rhythms.
So if we're on the hospitalist service and we have a patient with a brand new diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, are those the patients that we should be referring to an EP cardiologist to have that discussion about whether they should get an early ablation, see if we can head it off at the pass before it becomes a chronic progressive disease?
And maybe Dr. Munch, within that question, sorry to interrupt, briefly, you know, I should have looked into this myself, but, you know, how often are you seeing folks who have, you know, pneumonia or cellulitis, who, you know, had AFib in the hospital that was picked up on tele? And, you know, what do you do with those folks? I guess that's a sort of a separate question, but is that just, you know, sort of catecholamines and being sick and we shouldn't worry about it while we have you here, which is completely unrelated to these trials, but I wonder what your thoughts might be.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to answer. So we just completed a meta-analysis of four trials in early and AF and stop AF are part of it, because these now are four trials that look at what to do with the first really decision point. Cabana didn't do that, and East AFNet, they had to be within a year, but these are really first pivot points. What do we do? And now we have two trials in early paroxysmal healthy patients for the procedure that show ablation is more effective. And so when I see patients since over this past year with these three big trials, if we include East AFNet, and I can now tell them that ablation is better than medicines. That doesn't mean medicines won't work for them, and that doesn't mean we can't treat them safely with medicines, but if you want on average, ablation is better. And the second thing that I tell them now is, if we're going to do it, we need to start it early. Because a lot of people, like high blood pressure, are saying, you know, it's just white coat hypertension, give me another 6 months to lose weight, and they come back in 6 months and they're heavier and they have more hypertension. So we have to start earlier. We need to get them engaged quicker. And when we look at patients here at University of Utah, you take 5,000 people, about 300 to 4 of them will ultimately make it, with AFib, will make it to EP. So we'd like to see more of them. To your question, in the hospital, it gets at a lot of things. Is it symptomatic? Is it reversible? Most of the time, arrhythmia related to things like infection, like cellulitis and things, typically they're substrate. You'll see that their left atrium's enlarged. They have hypertension. They're older. So it may not be fully reversible. Of course, pericarditis and sometimes PEs or post-surgery, like cardiac surgery, it could be reversible, but most of the patients that would come into a medicine service outside of those conditions, I'd have a strong suspicion that there's going to be more in the future. And that becomes important for stroke management, anticoagulation use, and then getting them into a pipeline to treat. I still think we have to be hesitant as far as going beyond quality of life treatment, rhythm control treatment. You know, someone's completely asymptomatic and you just see it on the monitor, I don't think that they need to go right away to an ablation. But getting in the pipeline and understanding symptoms and how we can help is welcome.
So is this something that insurance companies will readily cover for patients, or is it something where the guidelines will have to change and actually recommend early ablation before it'll become more accessible?
So the guidelines have already made that change that you don't have to start a medicine first. And so there is that transition. Most insurers, at least our area, will pay for that. But we have somebody that we employ basically just to make sure that it's approved. I haven't had a denial yet since being at the University of Utah, but you never know. I had a denial 3 weeks ago for a person that came in the emergency room with complete heart block, and the insurance denied the pacemaker. And when I called them, they told me I had 72 hours to appeal. And I said, this isn't a nose job. This is life support. This is ACLS. And so anyway, see, I wouldn't put it beyond an insurer to deny it, but it is getting better. When I do see patients, our tools are titanium based because they have to be inert in the body, and the cost needs to be considered, particularly in a high deductible plan, or if they met their deductible, a lot of them are interested at that time.
Any more questions, Dr. Rupp?
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know, Dr. Bunch, if you read there's an editorial with these two trials in the New England Journal, and, you know, the author sort of talks about how this might not be generalizable to other AF populations, might not be generalizable to other ablation techniques. it sounds like maybe the ablation technique, you don't feel as that's as applicable as she might. I think it was a she. But anyway, you know, the editorial I thought was also interesting and brought up some good points about these are good trials for, you know, early symptomatic, you know, kind of relatively healthy folks, but we might not be able to make leaps, you know, further at this point. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that procedural experience is very critical. And when you look at population data of people that do 20 or less ablations a year, the success rates are nowhere near as good as these, and the complication rates are multiple magnitudes higher. That's a little bit better from 20 to 50, a little bit better from 50 to 100, but really you need a center where these your operators are doing well over 100 AF ablations a year. And the center needs to, because that involves nurses and staffs and technicians and surgeons, and so that whole team's there. So it's super critical, particularly there's a trial that shows the value in heart failure patients with ablation. When you get sicker patients, you really need a center that's experienced. So we put out a document really with the Heart Rhythm Studies talking about the need for AFib centers so we can augment, you know, experience in focal centers to maximize outcomes. And again, these are healthier people, longstanding persistent atrial fibrillation patients. In Cabana, the groups that tend to do better were young men. And people that tended to do worse were elderly women. So an elderly female over 75, persistent AFib, ablation may not help at all, and there could be a trend towards harm. So you're very right and with that.
So if I have a patient that I want to be seen, should I have them see the general cardiologist first or just ship them right over to you guys in EP?
Either way, I know that our general group is anxious to see him. We need a documentation of arrhythmia. Typically, we want a stress test because, again, the stress test tells us, can I use flecainide versus amiodarone? Are they safe for anesthesia? So with those two tests, we're happy to see him even without seeing cardiology. It's a direct referral to us. We're happy to see him. But, again, general cardiology, we mentioned it, they said they're happy to see him as well. So, but our passion is AFib, and theirs is stents and troponins.
So. Oh, they love it.
We're more than happy to see them.
All right. Well, we'll let you get back to your family tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. We'll see.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you, Dr. Bunch. Well, should we wrap it up with a few blurbs?
Should we banter? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, banter. So the Jazz were like on a pretty good streak.
They are on a pretty good streak.
Was it the Nuggets that dethroned them, or what happened there?
Well, they won last night. I think they did lose to the Nuggets. I think you're right. But they're like, I don't know for sure, but they're still top in the West.
That's pretty crazy. Are we a dark horse candidate this year? Is it going to happen?
honestly, no. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we'll actually challenge for the championship, but I think we're a good team, and I think we're getting better. I don't think we'll be – yeah, there's no way in my mind that we could get past the Lakers in a 7-game series, even if we make it to the Western Conference Finals. But I'm excited. It's been good.
Mm-hmm. I haven't watched the game yet. I haven't figured out how to watch it. So
you can definitely find illegal streams online, but it also will give you tons of malware and viruses. And if you do it on your phone, it you know, I think the phone seems impervious to that stuff. But
here at Last Week in Medicine, we do not condone the use of Reddit streaming to watch basketball games.
Dude, speaking of Reddit, I mean, are we going to talk about Game Stonk?
Game Stonk. Did you buy any Game Stonks?
No, dude. Did you?
No.
Okay.
Not after Robinhood shut it down. I was like half tempted to download Robinhood and buy like one share.
So you could say you were a part of it?
Well, you know, by the time they shut it down, though, like, you know, it was already starting to go the other way. So did you see that Rob Portnoy lost like $700,000?
I didn't see that, but good. I mean, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was interesting, right? Because it was like initially played up as this populist revolt against hedge funds, but it was actually just a bunch of like actual Wall Street insiders kind of posing as, you know, these basement dwellers that like were, you know, some of them really were basement dwellers, but I mean, like, there were smart people that knew this was a good opportunity and they started the push. And then definitely the meme people jumped on the bandwagon and drove the surge. But you kind of, it almost is like the smart investors were taking advantage of a bunch of stupid people. And so really there were no real good guys that won, I feel like, except for like the handful of like high school kids that made like, you know, $100,000 or something. That was cool.
But aren't they like the scabs anyway? Like this whole hold the line. I don't fully get this whole hold the line thing. Like, yeah, you're still trying to like hurt the hedge funds, but by holding, you're going to make them buy back the shares. I truly don't really get it, but you're supposed to hold on to it if you're like, if you're for the people or something, right?
Well, because as soon as you start selling, the price plummets, right? So hold the line is just let me sell my stocks first, and then you can be the guy holding the bag.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It was kind of insane. I mean, I don't know if I told you this. My aunt bought us shares of GameStop like randomly when we were like kids. She bought me like Columbia. She bought my siblings like Disney. Like there was a couple of companies, just like childhood companies that she had bought for us. Random. And I actually did not have any GameStop stock, but my sister had like three shares and she made like $3,000.
Really?
Or like five shares or whatever, you know. She sold at the top. Oh, she sold. Yeah, I think she actually sold before it got to the top. She sold like the 300s. Wow. I think my brother did too. My brother also bought Dogecoin though. But it's just like, I don't know.
Well, he just wants to lose all of his money then.
Yeah. The insiders are always going to win, right? Like until there's true, like significant political change, until Warren takes over, like the insiders are always going to win, right? I mean, it's just the way it is.
Dude, it's Warren. And I'm a little confused. Warren and Bernie on finance committee.
Oh, and nice.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no, Bernie's budget. He's the budget chairman. Warren's on finance. Things could get better. Who knows?
Fair enough. I mean, selfishly, like, I want the stock market to continue to do well. Oh, good, right? I mean, that's like...
It's completely detached from reality. It will continue to go up.
But it's like I was kind of like cheering for like sticking it to the hedge fund people, but also like I don't want there to be too much, you know, tumult going on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was nice to see a couple hedge fund guys lose billions of dollars. Like, yeah, nobody cries for those people. Right. But we don't want too much volatility because we're index fund guys and we just want that steady appreciation.
Exactly.
So in 30 years we can retire.
Exactly. Now what?
I thought there was that one interesting paper in JAMA about whether or not you should discontinue ACE and ARBs in patients with COVID. And I thought that was, I remember this coming up a lot early in the pandemic. Everyone's like, should we stop ACE inhibitors? Because the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 is the receptor for SARS-CoV-2. So theoretically, you know, if we're blocking the ACE and you have upregulation of those receptors, maybe more virus gets in and causes more damage. So we should stop everyone's ACEs and ARBs. And that was not based on anything except theoretical, you know, thinking. So this study actually wanted to see if that was the case. It was in Brazil. They had 659 patients with mild to moderate COVID. They randomized them to stopping or continuing their ACE or ARB. Very simple. The primary outcome was number of days alive and out of the hospital through 30 days. That's a nice outcome. Easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And it turns out there's no significant difference in number of days alive and out of the hospital, 21.9 versus 22.9 days. No significant difference in death, no difference in COVID-19 progression. So you can continue your patient's ACE or ARB. But I feel like half the time they come in with like a little bit of an acute kidney injury and you're going to hold it anyway.
Right. You stop an ACE or an ARB 90% of the time patients get admitted to the hospital anyway.
Yeah. Oh, you're septic. We'll hold your antihypertensive. Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, but that's like
restart it.
Yeah, restart it. Fair enough. That's all this physiology. You know what I mean? Like all these IL-6 and ACE receptors, it's like none of it pans out. Anyway, I'm just completely degrading the science behind what we do. So
Tocilizumab. Okay, so what blurb do you have?
Yeah, so I thought this appendicitis paper was reasonably interesting. You know, effect of oral moxifloxacin versus intravenous ertapenem plus oral levofloxacin for treatment of uncomplicated acute appendicitis. It was in JAMA last month. Basically, you know, antibiotics are safe compared to appendectomy in acute uncomplicated appendicitis. And this trial looked at folks who had CT-confirmed uncomplicated appendicitis, and they were randomized to oral antibiotics only versus IV followed by oral antibiotics. As the title states, you know, the regimens were moxifloxacin alone for 7 days versus 2 days of IV ertapenem followed by 5 days of oral levofloxacin and metronidazole. The primary outcome was treatment success rate at 1 year, which was defined as discharge home from hospital without surgery and no recurrent appendicitis. So oral only, that was met in 70.2% of folks versus IV was 73.8% of folks. So further evidence that antibiotics alone is reasonable, but the criteria did not, for non-inferiority, were not met based on a too wide of a confidence interval. So oral antibiotics are not non-inferior to IV followed by oral antibiotics. You can't really say, this wasn't looking at inferior, right? They were just trying to prove non-inferiority. So, you know, that's a little bit of weird language, but basically, you know, we'll still let the surgeons decide, but, you know, antibiotics are okay and IV is probably still preferred for appendicitis.
It's kind of interesting just to look at the antibiotics they chose, like moxifloxacin. I don't even know if we can get that at our hospital. I guess I think I've used it in some random patients before, but ertapenem seems like maybe too broad for just run-of-the-mill appendicitis. I was looking at our institution's recommendations for intra-abdominal infections. And we use, our recommendation is cefazolin and metronidazole, which I'm like, whoa, that's quite narrow. And so interesting to me. I mean, I wonder if Emily Spivak had a heart attack when she saw that article come out. She's like, oh no, everyone's going to get ertapenem now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Cefazolin plus flagyl. I see them, you know, go out on cefuroxime plus flagyl as an oral regimen. So yeah, levofloxacin plus flagyl seems like overkill there too. Uh-huh. But cefazolin or like, you know, PO like and cef, like that would be, or Keflex, excuse me. That would be kind of, I'm losing my touch, man. That would make me feel a little nervous, I guess, but I don't know. Yeah, you're probably right. Ertapenem's probably overkill.
Yeah. Well, I kind of get nervous when I see these appendicitis with antibiotics trials, because I know that eventually general surgery is going to make us start admitting all of them. We're going to be like, oh, we're not doing surgery. You can give them antibiotics. We don't want to be involved. Surgery signing off.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Just take it out. Just take out the appendix. It doesn't do anything.
It's complicated. I saw an appendicolith on that CT. Okay.
I will say that in the pediatric world, I feel like they're too aggressive about taking them out. Speaking from my own experience, they took my older son's appendix out, and all he had was gastroenteritis.
Oh.
And so, boom, beginning of the summer, now he's had laparoscopic surgery, you know, can't have fun or swim for a few weeks. And then he freaking had a closed loop small bowel obstruction because of the staple line from the appendectomy. So anyway, maybe we shouldn't take all the appendixes out. We should just give them ertapenem.
Noted. Cool. Well, I also, you know, thought this rifaximin paper was mildly interesting. You know, it was in Annals, published this month. The efficacy of rifaximin in secondary prevention of overt hepatic encephalopathy is well documented, but we don't know if it's good for primary prevention, especially in the setting of TIPS. So they basically had 197 patients. They randomized them to rifaximin or placebo, and the rifaximin folks had less overt hepatic encephalopathy. So we should be using more rifaximin in the setting of post-TIPS to prevent HE.
If only insurance companies agreed. That's like
very good point.
One of the most common drugs we can't get covered, and it's extremely frustrating because nobody likes taking lactulose.
Good point. And then, I mean, I don't know if you have anything else, but our very own Dr. Insa, do you know? I don't actually know.
Let's go with Insa.
Our very own Dr. Insa had an editorial or a letter published in the New England Journal of Medicine on January 28th of this year. It's called At the Cusp, Reimagining Infective Endocarditis Care Amid the Opioid Epidemic. And it is really well done. He brings up a lot of good issues. He talks about a success story with a particular patient who has opiate use disorder with IV drug use and got endocarditis because of that. And then he picked her up post-discharge with her, you know, tricuspid valve in tatters. The surgeons wouldn't operate because she was an active, you know, substance user, had active opiate use disorder. She needed oxygen that she didn't have. She needed home health, which she didn't have. She was in active opiate withdrawal when he saw her virtually. You know, it sounded like this happened pretty recently. She's on the screen there under a blanket with no oxygen, like shivering, and probably should have gone back to the hospital. But, it sounds like he managed everything as an outpatient, pulled in a multidisciplinary team, and sort of through strength of will, you know, got her a new valve eventually, and a huge success story. So it brought up a lot of things, you know, how much individual will it would be required to do something like that. And is that really, you know, it seems like a failure of the system, right? So he advocates for infective endocarditis teams, which, you know, Dr. Bunch advocated for AFib teams. So everyone wants a team for their thing, but that brings up, you know, other issues. But we're in, you know, the opiate epidemic. We see a lot of infective endocarditis secondary to opiate use disorder. And the editorial or letter brings up a lot of good points and, you know, made me think about how we care for these folks in the hospital, what happens to them afterwards, and how we could all do better. So recommend it.
Yeah, it was really good. Gosh, I hope it wasn't the patient that I discharged a few months ago. Because that's just, you know, these stories do have patterns. But yeah, like, it's just heartbreaking because you take care of these patients, you get them through their withdrawal, right? When they're feeling terrible and maybe they're a little hostile, and then you finally get them feeling better so they can act like a normal person, and you get them on their antibiotics, and you somehow find a way to get them 6 to 8 weeks of IV antibiotics. Maybe you're able to get them a new valve, and then they get discharged, and then 2 weeks later they're back with sepsis and bacteremia. And it's just like, we failed you. Like, as a society, we failed you. As a healthcare system, we failed you. Like, this shouldn't happen. And obviously there's personal responsibility too, but we are so terrible at managing this as a disease. And you just, now you got a surgeon who's like, I'm not going to touch that person again because they relapse. And you're like, so you're sentencing that person to death because that valve is wide open, or there's a 2 centimeter vegetation on it. You know, it's just like, the hardest cases, I think.
And there's so much compartmentalization of it where you can kind of just divorce yourself from really, you know, looking at the human that this is that's going through this, right? I mean, we do that all the time. Like, you put in a ton of work to get him to discharge. So you're like, oh, you know, like, okay, like, I've got you all set up. I've got you discharged. Presumably the SNF puts in a ton of work to, you know, take care of them while they're there. The PCP obviously puts in a ton of work, but it's like, it's so siloed and compartmentalized. You know, the surgeon kind of can divorce themselves from it because they're not going to do well if they relapse again. But then the addiction doc is, I mean, it's just, it's a mess for sure. And you can just divorce yourself from it fairly easily, but we shouldn't do that. And we should have teams, and Dr. Insa is the bomb.
Yes, sir. All right. I had one final blurb.
Oh, yeah.
this is very blurb heavy, but I got to get it in there. Okay, so this one was published January 20th in the New England Journal. This was the lower or higher oxygenation targets for acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. So they basically, someone hypothesized that a lower target for partial pressure of arterial oxygen would result in a lower mortality rate than a higher target. They thought 60 would be better than 90 for patients who were intubated. Or I think they could also be on high flow with a 50% or something, or they had to be on at least 10 liters of oxygen. Anyway, they were targeting 60 versus 90. They randomized 2,928 adults admitted to ICU. And the mortality rates were like identical in both groups. So it turns out 60 versus 90 does not matter, which I don't think this is very practice changing, because I feel like all the ICUs I worked in as a resident, 60% was your goal. And if you got over 60, then, you know, you weren't sweating it, but you weren't targeting above 60, right?
Yeah. I mean, right. This doesn't affect our practice all that much. And PaO2s are not something that we deal with very frequently. But I guess they were, I didn't actually look into this, but they're hypothesizing that oxygen toxicity is bad, I suppose. Is that the theory?
Yeah,
which you do hear about a lot in the ICUs, but maybe that's just pish posh. Probably not, but okay. Anyway, 60 versus 90 is no difference.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well,
how you know? Doesn't matter.
Physiology, it's out.
Okay, well, that was an action-packed hour. It was a long one. Thanks for sticking with us if you're still listening.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been real.